I don't, our conversation is, well, I guess, a background one, and though I should certainly like to, you might develop as a part of it. You'll see the transcript, you can look at it and see what you want to put on or off or background or quotable if you want to. I would like to know, to start with, what you know of the genesis of the sit-ins in Nashville.
That I couldn't tell you about.
You came in after.
I came here in December 61, and the movement was here.
I forgot you said 2 years ago. Yeah. And you weren't in at the time of negotiations either, wind up. This fact that I did not know until you told me a little while ago, the things that now you're an anthropologist, and that's great. I'd love to hear you talk about the whole notion of the psychic split in the Negroes, if they were the thing, the pull toward negritude and the Mystic Noir, or the black man's culture, or the dream of Africa, any of those things, as opposed to the impulse to enter, the mainstream of Western culture, and in the end, perhaps lose identity. And I get all sorts of different replies to that notion, you see.
I imagine you would.
All sorts of different replies.
My own ideas change on it.
They do.
Frankly, I feel that for the next few years we're going to see an increase in black chauvinism, whatever you want to call it. I don't think it can withstand the pull of the dominant culture at all. I just don't see it as an anthropologist. Theoretically, I don't see it, and from the standpoint of people I know who are not, say, involved so thoroughly in the movement and who are not as prone to go all out on this, it just seems to me that be a very unlikely development that you would get a long-term expression of this, maybe 10, 20 years. I would even be doubtful if it would last this long.
Let me try the Well, apparently this is a problem for a good many Negroes to talk about it that way. Some sense of a real split in feeling. Some really
I'm sure it is. I mean, I can see it. I have a feeling in a sense that an expression of it really hasn't been possible or permitted until but relatively recently. And that it's a very human reaction, I think, to the situation. I forget who it was that said, well, white people talked about color for so long that the Negroes finally decided it was important. But this is the sort of thing that we're getting now. But when you think of the figure I always like to use is, what is the world going to be like in the year 2000? And I just can't see that I can certainly see amount of pride in one's background and so forth. I really can't see Negroes developing into a minority on the order of the Jews or anything of that
sort. You don't see that?
No.
But certain Jews that I know, including a couple of psychiatrists, draw the parallel between the split some Jews feel, even Jews who have no religion, and the Negro situation in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
But one other thing related to this, and I don't know how much of a question this really is, you read and people say that the cutting edge of the present, you know, civil rights and the new Negro and all of this pattern of things is dependent upon the fact that the Negro has changed his view of himself, has accepted his identity, his identification with the Negro race, or the Negro group, or the Negro culture, or any of these things you want to say it. This discovery of the self has given the cutting edge, psychologically. If that's true, then it is not merely a detail, then black shoulders is not merely a detail in this, if you want to equate that with black shoulders, which I don't think is necessary either, probably. But how would that, what kind of lead would that give you to?
Well, I think you can make a distinction between... You can make a distinction between what I call black chauvinism, of course, the most virulent expression is the Muslim movement, and a simple feeling of worth, a feeling of pride. As I say this, I think there is a difference. And what I was referring to in particular was that the expression on the order of the Muslim movement, I cannot see being a permanent feature. This other will last in varying degrees. There will be families that will be horrified when prospective white brides or husbands are brought home. It's just there will be on the other side of the line. And I certainly don't see a real quick physical amalgamation, no. But I don't think that the barriers are nearly as strong. And in areas, small areas, sort of marginal areas to the general society, where these things have lost their potency, the obstacles disappear. So that I think it will be an eventual prospect. I don't think it's a very important one from the standpoint of Negroes, and I think a great many Negroes are beginning to look at this with a certain amount of fear that this may be, and
the fear of the loss of identity,
the fear of the loss of the group, yes. And I wouldn't predict 100% because there are too many factors in the world that are going to influence this that we don't even know about, we haven't identified. This is too far in the future. I'm thinking partly in these terms because yesterday we had a group of students from Colombia, South America, here. And they were looking for the solution to the problem. And finally I said to them, I said, well, at one time Colombia had approximately the same percentage as the Negroes and white people in the United States today. And I said, you seem to have rather successfully integrated, and in appearances, it was obvious too.
How much do you think is in S.N. Houdin's notion of the secret motivation, if that's the right word, in the black Muslim redemption of the outcast and all of that, the pride and the poor, as a way of channeling ambitions, aspirations to join the middle class white world to accept its values, strange back door way of getting into the middle class, rather than a way of withdrawing from American white middle class value.
Well, I must confess, I have not read his book. I read Lincoln's book.
That's about it. He was saying, instead of this apparent exclusiveness and chauvinism, I really conceals the impulse of the training schools and all this to come back into the standard
it sounds very
values.
sounds very reasonable to me, B, and this is the reason I said what I did at the beginning. The pull of Western civilization, even on people who thoroughly dislike it, who thoroughly suffered from it, is so tremendous today that I can't see it being withstood. And this is an I'm going to have to read the book now that I'm interested in this. I hadn't heard that something like this was in it. In a sense, you can look at the Muslims and say, well, this is a substitute for this acceptance. But after all, the black Muslims are Americans. They grew up in America. Their cultural background is America. And they can study the Quran and learn Arabic all they want to. They're still Americans. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all sorts of covert acceptance of ideals at the same time that these are being rejected overtly.
That's one of his ideas in the book. I mean, goes at some length.
You're really digging it in the area where you can't prove anything. I'll say
that's
that
right,
much.
You can't prove anything.
And as I mentioned that we don't really have all the facts, and we don't know how to deal with them. Certainly, the fact that Negroes are pulled every which way today is true.
The reason for probing, in my modest way, into such a question, is based on the notion that the attitude towards such questions modifies the line of action that Negro will take. See what I mean?
Well,
his opinion, or his inclination to the question, I guess, modifies what he's going to do in the world of reason action. You find a strange thing like this. I talked the other day, a week or 2 weeks ago, with a very well-known Negro lawyer in New Orleans, who's a man of high intelligence and very good education and good instincts, you see. And he's a lawyer for one of the associated with the civil rights groups. And one of those is certainly not a black Muslim. He's nonviolent, so, you know. And he finally burst out and said, after a long conversation, the white man can't be redeemed. They're all the same. Going to be a few, but not many. And said, I'm beginning to be a black Muslim. It's against my feelings and against my philosophical principles. But this is the way I'm being forced. Now, I'm actually getting a literature now and going into, not into organization, but into this. I hate to say, but this is true.
Well, certainly, you see, as the past few years have gone by, particularly the last year, and Lord knows what we're going to see this year in some places, Congress or no, this is one of the reasons I feel, as I said, that this is going to be heightened for a period. I can feel it myself. I'm not close to it. I'm not nonviolent by I'm nonviolent tactically. In other words, this has been a good tactic and it's worked. And it,
you say you for nonviolence as a tactic.
Yes, it's not really a part of my philosophy of life in every respect. And I've watched, well, it was in Nashville when I first saw people throwing bricks and rocks at people. And you get to the point where I was saying to myself, well, I don't want to, I'd like to see some heads crack myself if I could just guarantee they were the right ones. Of course, in a sense, there are no right heads. Everybody's doing what they feel they have to do. But this is the sort of feeling that this was the end result of a sit-in, in other words. The police protected them while they were ticketing, but when they went, when they left, there was no protection. That's very often when the trouble began. And it's, I have been, in a sense, close to the civil rights movement in one way all my life, but mostly as an interested reader. And I hadn't been in the South for years. And I came back, and this happened about 4 months after I'd been here, and it took a week to get over it. I've just never seen people behave in that way. And when you go through this over and over again, and it's almost easier to forgive the people who are throwing the rocks than it is the people who are just standing by watching, doing nothing. And this is why I think people begin to feel, well, white race is worthless, poor person. I can't ordinarily think in terms of redeeming a group of people. I mean, these terms mean really nothing to me because I don't look at people that way. White race is no worse than any other race. I mean, they respond to their culture, and their culture has been particularly unfortunate in this particular regard. And that's that. I mean, but certainly I see why people feel this way. And I think this feeling is probably a lot stronger in the North than it is in the South in Negro communities.
That apparently is true. That leads me to anecdote.
There again, you see, you can almost forgive the guy that hits you, but the guy that just stands by and is completely indifferent to your fate, which is what usually Northern Negroes put up with.
He doesn't know you are there.
Yeah.
That's the greatest assault on you possible. I know one young lady who's very bright, stands very high in a second class of law school. She's a Negro. She says that she is very optimistic about the settlement herself in the relatively near future. So the common history, the white man, the Negro, and her phrase, being on the land that long together, gives some basis for human recognitions. Even in the middle of brick throwing or gun shooting, some human recognitions that are possible. It's not, as you were saying, indifferent and detached. It's real. It's personal. She said, this basis is some hope for a society to come out of it in a reasonable time. She went on to say, well, what scares her is Harlem or Detroit or Chicago, where she sees no basis for the human recognitions. Does this make any sense to you? She's been to the mill. She's been in jail. She's been thinking about it. She's had it rough. She's not just speaking from an academic point of view.
Yeah, it does in some ways, and I've felt this way before I came back to the South, believe it or not. And I've probably been as guilty as anybody of laying too much stress on the sins of the overt segregationists and not knowing enough about what was going on in the North and in the West. But it's questionable to me whether Nashville, for example, would become a community of that sort before it would merely become an American big city and go through what the North is going through now. Now, there's indications in Louisville, for example, that this is going on. There was a very good article in The Reporter called The Southern City with Northern Problems. And the mere solution of the knocking down the customary barriers of segregation, the legal ones and the ones that have been so insisted on in the South, does not seem to have produced this kind of rapport that we had hoped for. And I've heard Leslie Dunbar say the same thing, that we who think that the South should do better can keep hoping, but there doesn't seem to be any basis for this. Now, I am generally an optimist on the whole situation, but I was thinking as we were talking about, as I put it so far forward, what our Negro is going to be thinking about in 10 or 20 years, I do have a certain amount of feeling that our system may break down on this point, which no telling what anybody will be thinking about in 10 or 20 years. We have come so close to it over and
break
over
down
again.
Break down our system?
Yes.
In what way?
Politically, economically, though this may be in that sense more of a contributory factor than a direct one. Certainly it's showing up the strains in our economic system.
You mean the problem of unemployment?
The differential unemployment rates. But politically, you see, it's just really touch and go now when the president has to be sending troops down south every once in a while. And you can find northern examples within city governments where the wheels are just practically ground down. Nobody can figure out what to do. And the pressures seem to be so evenly divided that nothing gets done. And when you find an incident like the Cleveland School Board, they can't really decide what to do. Cleveland is supposed to be a pretty good community. No white person was arrested for molesting Negroes on front of that school. You might look at it the other way around. Maybe the North is going to get the South's problems, too, on this. Where the real overt expression of a prejudice which has been there all the time, but had never really been called into... had never really had to be exercised in this fashion.
That was the personal contact, wasn't it, Isaiah?
Now, I know that's been one of the standard gambits of the segregationists. Well, the North just doesn't know what they have to deal with.
That doesn't mean the segregation is wrong on that point, though. Mm.
No, I think, I certainly think that, you can see it in the, you see a map of where schools are desegregated. There's certainly a correlation between feeling and Negro population density, so you could carry this further. But in metropolitan areas where this density begins to reach a point of, as it has in Washington and it's going to in Chicago and in a great many other cities, of course complicated by all kinds of other factors, but where this is a factor. I mean, after all, it would never have come about if there had not been a fairly large number of Negroes. And there's one statistic I always quote to foreigners, and I usually try to quote it to people here. It's that not many white Americans realize that in the original 13 colonies, one quarter of the population was Negro. And it was still at 14% at the time of the Civil War. I don't know how many states at that period in the South had Negro majority, but I know there were several.
Alabama, Mississippi.
Yes. Mississippi still had one in 1930. Yes. I don't know when the switch took place.
Well, some Negroes in Mississippi will say, these are responsible people, that they lost Negroes on the census. There are more Negroes, higher proportion of Mississippi than the census showed.
I expect that's true.
I don't know all the arguments. There's a statistical argument for this, based on correlation figures.
Well, I heard at one point that any census that could be considered accurate within 20% was a good one, so I assume we have a good one. But sure, people are lost all over. And considering the... type of life of Mississippi Negroes in particular, I would suspect this is true.
As you were saying, one of the standard gambits of the segregationists is to say to the Yankee. See, when you get the problem, you act the way we act. You were just unrealistic. You didn't have it yourself. But is there the possibility that as the race difficulties become national, that the Southerners, some anyway, will take a different view from that, that they will feel it's a national problem, the Yankees stuck with it too, I am no longer either Southerner at the end of the pointing pharisaical finger, but now we must deal with a different spirit, the more realistic spirit. He's relieved then of his burden of anger and resentment at being at the end of that particular score. Is there some possible release into rationality because of the fact of a national problem emerging rather than as opposed to a sectional problem?
Well, I think, I would hope so, and I think you can see signs of, I'm not certain that's the only motivation for it, but you certainly see signs all over of, in many cases, very reluctant, and from the standpoint of Negroes, very pathetic and half-hearted and, in a sense, worthless change in opinion. In other words, you see this gap of 5 years or more, white people have accepted what Negroes were saying 10 years ago, but they haven't accepted what they're saying last month yet. In fact, I couldn't help but laugh. One of the groups here was actually told last year, why don't you have that nice kind of demonstration you had in 1960? Well, you know what they were telling them in 1960, but now all they were asking was a nice demonstration. They didn't want any rowdy people downtown. I think this may be part of it, and it's so tied up with so many other things, too, all the other pressures that are pushing erasing the division, the industrialization, the urbanization, all the things that were viewed with such alarm from across town in the late 20s. You can't avoid them. I mean, they're here. We've got to learn to live with them in every aspect of our lives. And then, of course, there's the foreign push. And I've always felt, too, that it wasn't so much that intelligent outsiders, at any rate, were putting us down for being mean, being unjust, because all they had to do, really, was to look around in their own country. No country guarantees absolute justice. But the fact that we were claiming to be so efficient, and here we are, this wonderful system, as I say, we're at the point now where there is, I think, ground for wonder whether it's going to pull through, whether it's flexible enough to make the changes, our attitudinal systems, our political system, across the board here. And I think that this is where we really begin to look silly, as I say, to people outside the country. We claim to sort of know everything, and here we are with what in many of their countries is a relatively simple problem. They got serious problems of other kinds, and here we are tearing ourselves apart over it. And I think this, the idea of the irrationality of maintaining this kind of system in the kind of world we live in today is entering into people, and I hope it may come a little quicker in the South because of they've been thinking about it longer, and they've tried every other idea, none of which have worked in a sense. As vicious as segregation was, it was really a very half-hearted attempt, if you want to look at it in one way, to do what the politicians said had to be done. In one sense, the fact it didn't work over the long period. Well, it might have if the South had been isolated. We don't know. That's an iffy question. But it certainly permitted far too much exercise of initiative and ability to really keep the situation stable, I think.
You mean when Bilbo finances Negro boys going to school, dig is up?
Yeah, in a sense, it is.
Or when Easton sends kids to school, as he does, I've told on pretty good authority, in Mississippi now, yes.
His daughter, I've heard.
Well, that's
and well, that's another factor too. I mean, which is a minor one, I think, but it certainly is there too.
Well, Frederick Douglass plays, you know, first he teaches the alphabet, and the game is over.
Yeah, well, certainly over the long run, that's true. In other words, you can look on segregation as an attempt to prevent what we call diffusion in anthropology. In other words, to prevent in anthropology, to prevent the transmission of those democratizing items from the majority culture. And it certainly slowed them down and created tremendous psychic havoc. But, as I say, in a sense, you can call it a failure. If only very pragmatically, because it's breaking down. Well, of course, this is because the South is in is part of a larger country, which is also part of a larger world. And I think that in the long run, the same type of rational approach, these same stresses are going to operate in somewhat different fashion on the northern situation. Because how much longer can we afford to make paupers that we have to support in this country? It's a ridiculous system. You keep people from getting ahead, and then what happens?
It's expensive.
It's very, very expensive. And I don't think we'll ever know the true expense of it. How much of what we put into police departments, relief programs, the waste of talent in general all across the board is out on the streets making trouble instead of doing something constructive. But this is, of course, all part of what I was saying, was that our system is certainly under serious stresses.
How much resistance would you find around here in Tennessee to the white sympathizer or the white liberal who wants to move in and take part in the Negro movement? In Mississippi, this is very commonly said. I mean, people who are in the very center of it, who are very deeply involved in it, well, I mean, people like Robert Moses would say what you say, and others say it. And Eddie Day, who's a professor of sociology, took me aside and began to explain this to me.
Yeah, Jackson State?
Yes, Miss Clark. That's Clark, Jackson Clark.
Mm-hmm.
You know her?
I've met her.
Well, she just put herself together to talk about this, but it's not just one place. It might be a teacher at Jackson State, or it might be Robert Moses, or it might be this person or that person. 7-8 people come to this point. The outsiders, you know, white or Negro, but primarily white, who come in with better educations, most of them. And in very soon friction develops, serious friction in some of these cases. Resentment from the local Negroes who are in the movement, not the torpid outsiders, you see, but the people who are active and in the movement and even educated.
I can, there are all kinds of things that can happen. I feel here, almost, my feeling has been that and this you find in other places too, that white people who are presumably friendly to the movement are accepted with a little too, with not enough criticism. In other words, there's still...
Not enough criticism from the Negroes.
Yeah. There's still enough, it seems to me, of the old feeling that, well, we're glad there are some of them that are decent, or however you want to put it, that they are not judged, in a sense, the way they would judge their neighbors. And, of course, it's very difficult to, in one way. You haven't been brought up, from their point of view, to judge white people in this way. For all the fact that, and it's very true, I think that Negroes know more about white people than the other way around, there are still areas of white life that the Negroes have not been able to to see with any clarity. And I haven't seen any cases of real friction, though I know of certain kinds of fight behavior which would certainly bring it about.
From people who have come into the,
yeah,
to help.
And I, as a matter of fact, I can see it myself. I resent certain white people that drop by here with wild ideas. They head for every trouble spot there is. You'd be surprised. There's Lewis Jones. Have you met him? Sociologist from
Tuskegee. I know
who
he is. I have no
idea. Well, he calls them wandering minstrels, anyway. When the trouble was going on in Fayette and Haywood counties, all kinds of strange people were wandering around there. And some of them end up doing good work, and some of them are worse than no good. You'd be better off without them. Now, with regards to the school situation, I suspect that I don't think there's much of it here, but I could see how a certain amount of resentment could spring up, if only the sort of envy, well, if I'd really had been able to get the kind of education this guy did, I'd be a hell of a lot better scholar or something like this.
The breakdown, as far as I can make it from these various conversations in Mississippi on this topic, which I did not initiate, this began just be volunteer. It was something close to the surface, you see.
Mm-hmm.
One, what you're saying, this kind of envy, the general envy, you see,
mm-hmm.
or resentment about inferior position. Second, the specific resentments, because the outsider, probably better trained by and large, tends to drift into command positions. If not top, at least, command posts here and there. And this puts him quickly in a position where some Negro has been yearning for, humanly, and expecting, perhaps. Then, Dr. Clark said, Dr. Jacqueline Clark, it's the girls. He said a lot of the Negro girls tend to take up for these outsiders, either the white outsider or the Negro outsider. These are romantic, exotic characters who come in. This has been a matter of real trouble.
Well, on the...
there's some other types.
I was thinking on the women in particular. In a sense, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
No way out of it.
Yourself aloof. Yeah, that's how it's assumed if you don't date locally. If you do, there's always somebody who's not going to like it. So.
There's no way out of that one.
You just operate the way you feel like operating. There are things, too, that a lot of white people are come into the situation. They think they know what it is. I've never heard a Negro complain about this, but I've seen it. This is another point. I hadn't really thought too much in general terms here. They are very upset when they find Negroes behaving just about the way they would behave in this situation. They have a very romantic approach to the thing. And sometimes it takes a while for this to get over. Well, during this period, they're likely to have rather extreme standards of behavior for Negroes. In other words, they should be putting their nose to the grindstone and folding those leaflets down at the NAACP instead of out getting drunk or something. And, there's all kinds of things. They're usually more amusing than anything else because with goodwill and a reasonable amount of good sense, I think usually gets straightened out. Now, it depends so much on individual cases. I'm interested. You must be able to get pretty deep with people that it did begin to come out in their conversations. But as I say, I'll come back to my original statement because I want to stress it. I do feel that by and large there is not enough suspicion of white people by Negroes. We had Billy Solasty speaking in a mass meeting here once. They didn't care really who he was. All he was a wealthy white man who was with them today. And I was pretty upset about it. But now I could make myself unpleasant by running around screaming and hollering. I didn't. I just
that lead into their sacred character, and let it go at that.
But another type of resentment that's reported to me, this is reported by Robert Moses. In fact, he brought this told topic up, the end of Eric. Resentment against a certain sentimental kind of white attitude, the white man who wants to move in and adopt, to go Negro, to adopt a certain vocabulary, to adopt certain stances, to adopt certain attitudes, get the lingo of the music, the lingo of this, the lingo of that. And he said this was mixed with contempt rather than as much as with resentment. Mixed with contempt as much as resentment. But people who didn't really have the lingo, didn't really have the sense, didn't really have the feel of what they were trying to move in on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's some contempt. Then resentment at the fact that white men's trying to take our ball and run with it.
And frankly, sometimes you don't know what to do. You do have dislike on the question of women. You have the feeling that whatever you do, some people are going to think you're stilted if you don't lapse into what seems to be the current language, or they'll think you're being silly. And then they know darn well that a man is not going to turn himself into a Negro in 30 days or 30 years, for that matter, if he wasn't born one. This is just, you can see it over and over again. You're dealing with a different culture, and you learn that culture in your childhood, and if you don't learn it then, you never will. Without the fact that, of course, without doing a Mr. Griffith trick, you're never going to look Negro enough.
There's one other aspect of it, though this has not been remarked on to me, but I wonder about it. Some sort of contempt or distrust, what I think they call the pathology of the left. People whose motives clearly are not anything except a kind of distortion of personality that brings them into this, mm-hmm. seeking aid and comfort from the other underprivileged. Mm-hmm. I'm hurt too, and you're hurt too, and we're clubbed together in some sense. That, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I have heard, Ralph Ellison once and say, you see, he's angry at a certain kind of fag liberal, you know. And out of his own infirmity, moves in to club up with the niggers, because we are all hurt together by a non-understanding world. That sort of telling us, this kind of resentment comes out of that. Apparently some of that, too, as far as you can
imagine. Well, there's certainly plenty of course.
I don't mean really homosexuality, I mean neurotic or pathological elements.
Well, I think that a lot of Negroes quickly sense these things in people. If this seems primary and the commitment to what's being done is secondary, there would undoubtedly be contempt. In other words, people that come down take a freedom ride to solve their emotional problems.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work, and they know it right away. I remember hearing a specific example just what you were talking about. We're a little bit more immune to that here because this isn't one of these things where people come and go and people get to know you and they see you around in this community. And then, of course, I don't know, though here again I think that probably feeling ought to be doing a lot more, though they're happy they're around, the white people of this community that are in organizations like the Nashville Community Relations Council. I think they feel they're nice to have around. I don't really think they do very much, but this wouldn't come in on that. You see, these are just well-meaning people who don't always really know.
Just ordinary well-meaning is.
But you see, the assumption that because I have a problem, whether it may be a big one or not, that therefore I know what your problem is and feel the way you do, is an arrogant one. And if people come in with that, it's undoubtedly they're going to have trouble.
It's probably even worse. They don't know they have a problem. They're acting unconsciously on it. That motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see differences or similarities between the old abolitionism and the present situation on psychological or other grounds?
Not much about that. Well, I guess I can just take it easy way out and say I can conceive of both.
It's
pretty difficult to compare historical movements. Now, working in an organization, as I do, which has its roots in the American Missionary Association, I guess I should say I see some similarities. The commitment of certain branches of Northern Protestantism has never wavered on this score. There's many other historic factors that are different.
Except at home.
Yeah, oh yeah. But
excuse me.
Well, you're right there. I do not stem from that background myself.
I'm kidding you now.
Well, one wonders about Mr. Higginson's private social life and so forth, but beyond that, it's something I'll think about now, but I can't really.
I don't know what I'll think about it. I don't know that I know enough to have any very considered opinion about it. I must say, on the whole, as a guest, just my slight acquaintance with this business, there seems to be now two differences. I'm going to try this anyway. I can believe it or not. There's probably even more pathology in the old abolition movement.
One thing I was going to say that I was certainly one of the similarities was that you got a lot of strange white people in both of them.
Yes, but more than, I mean, it's just, you can't get, you know, a garrison is really, you know, way out left field. And a lot of the others were too. There's more obviously than many people who are now concerned with. That's now more central to, issues more central to a standard social problem.
I think one thing that's not really relevant to the particular question you asked, one of the things that enters in here, is the recent convert to the movement, so to speak, white person, who has somehow or other shaken prejudice, as he was taught in some fashion or other, as a younger person. And just like any self-made man, he can never quite understand why other people can't do it too. With the same kind of attitudes and results, of course, in this case, where we like to have them. It doesn't work for a very clear understanding of the situation that you're dealing with. And I think that the Negroes, despite the fact that I see all kinds of evidence to the contrary, somehow do have, and despite the rhetoric used in mass meetings, somehow do have a perception of this as a conflict in social system, much more than a lot of white people do.
They see the dynamics of it more clearly than the white man, who tends to moralize it.
Yeah, who sees it as a... though, as I say, the rhetoric used in Negro mass meetings, you certainly hear things put in terms of white and black pretty frequently. But as I say, I would suspect that a clear understanding of this, even mine, with all the kind of training I've had, which should make me see it clearly, there are things that I just sit and wonder about.
Such as?
How could it... I can understand how it came about, how it... stood. I can't understand the depth of white feeling on the subject myself.
The segregationist feeling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. See, I fall into using terms very inaccurately here. And other things too, but in fact some of them there, I can't even phrase the question very well. I just know there's something here that doesn't work out with some nice little scheme of, I can take out of cultural anthropology. But as I say, I do have the feeling that rare, though, a clear understanding of this as a question of culture change, whatever you want to call it. That there may be a little more subconscious understanding of this on the part of Negroes than on the part of whites who are in the movement, so to speak, thinking of people in terms of activists, so to speak. I don't know, I may be all wet.
How would you respond to a notion such as this? You take the part of the situation of the Negro with his loss of direction and self-respect. He was deprived of a culture, whatever culture he had. He was lost. He was the man without a mooring, without an identity. And if I read the right books, I talk to the right people, part of the situation now is he's recovered an identity, a sense of a place in a culture, and an acceptance of his role as Negro. Has seen a role as Negro. Now let's take the same line of thought applied to the white Southerner. There are certain changes. The white Southerner feels he has an identity as Southerner. He also has an identity as American, but he feels an identity as Southerner. Mm. Many of them really do. Our way of life and all this sort of thing. Now, if he's uncritical and doesn't know very much history, he's inclined to have to buy the package of the way of life, including what is the present practice of segregation. It's been very different things in the past, of course, and the change has taken place. So he's really, in a sense, not merely keeping the Negro in his place, but he's trying to keep himself in his place. Mm. He's trying to keep his identity. He feels his identity threatened, not merely by the fact of a change in relation to the Negro, but by this is a symbol, or a tissue of symbols, of his basic identity. This is part of his own role. He's acting out something to keep his identity, to keep his cultural role. It's not just in isolation, what do I think about that Negro? Or what do I think about segregation even? Except as far as segregation means, as part of a pattern of thought, instinctively or accepted without criticism, as his identity, as his role. I'm putting this where, what do you see what I'm driving at?
Yeah, I do very clearly. I can, if I had that little machine with me on several occasions during our demonstrations, I could document it. There's a surprising lack of, there's, to me, it was surprising. What after all, it's surprising. There was much less what you call racial vituperation among white bystanders, and I would expect there is a tremendous amount of nostalgia and the feeling that the world has just gone mad. There's no place to stand anymore.
That's what I'm getting at.
This wouldn't have happened 20 years ago. And I guess the communists are taking over. I mean, of course, this always gets into it, but this is just a nasty word for the future to a lot of people.
It's a fear of disorientation.
Now, of course, social change is always rough on the people that it's happening to. But in our urban centers, where most people live today, it's much more on the surface. There are more ways to handle it, in a sense. You see changes much more rapidly. Well, sure, the South has seen them too, but the change that has come has moved at a slower pace. It's been harder, and it's paradoxical that the more changes this year, there will be twice as many more next year. But that doesn't make them any easier to take. As a matter of fact, you may be so upset by the changes of this year that you'll be completely floored by the ones that are going to come next year.
Now, what I'm getting at is this, is a corollary of that, or a consequence of that. If you can indicate to your Southerner that to be Southern doesn't necessarily involve segregation.
I thought James Dabbs tried to say.
But this is the old story of Thomas Jefferson, of course. somehow to just integrate this block conception, the general notion, into its elements. But your identity is not dependent upon that. Give your identity as Southern. The attack is not on, say, you're an American prejudice, or you're a Southerner prejudice, this being a Southerner mean. See what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily mean that. That isn't a necessary part of the picture for you. That's an accidental part of the picture. Is there any validity in that approach?
I think, well, as I would say over the long run, no. For the simple reason that not because, theoretically, it couldn't be true at all. Except that I do have the feeling that the other things which are considered part of the Southern way of life are casualties just as much as segregation of the modern world.
Some of them are, yeah, sure. But you could let those, fight those at a different level.
Yeah,
different
for them, I certainly think it is, it's a short-term, long-term thing again, just like my comments on black chauvinism. I think that it's a good ploy. I don't know how well it's working. I suspect that people like Mr. Dabbs get pretty discouraged. And the people that it's corollary with those men with the belief that the South has it in it to be better than the North on this question. And I don't know.
Some Negroes say that. Charles Evers said it to me a week ago. Otherwise, he wouldn't be in Mississippi. He said, well, I'd rather deal with segregation than I am. Whatever that means, it may be an irony, you know. And many black Muslims say that.
Oh, yeah, this is a, well, it's almost a standard response, I think. I don't know if it's all very well thought out or anything.
I don't know. I have no idea what it is. He's a Negro saying that, and I take him at his word. He feels that.
Mm-hmm.
And try to explore what he means by it, so far as I can in my blundering way. I think about how Ellis argued it, if you're interested. He said, insofar as there's a lot of bullies and cowards around, of course they always are, but by and large, these Mississippians have a sort of a simple code. And one thing they admire is nerve, is courage. But if they don't admire it, they feel they ought to admire it. And they feel trapped into acting courageously even if they're afraid. They're caught in this, so they have an old-fashioned code about this. Therefore, however grudgingly, if the Negro stands up to him, he begins to say, that guy's got nerve. Your working basis around that are right there. He's not afraid. He may be infuriated with the fact that first the Negro's not afraid, but he begins to respect it. So this is a basis of conversation. It's a basis of dealing with a man. Because he respects you simply in terms of this raw courage of it. Second, he says that these people tend to keep their word. That when they cross the line and make an agreement on some point, they tend to keep their word. They have crossed the line when they make the agreement for first. But the big lines are already crossed. He said, once we get to go at the table of negotiation, said, we're going to go fast because they'll keep their word. They won't try to trick you. So it isn't in their approach to things once they've crossed the line. Now, he may be dreaming.
Yeah, I was thinking that certainly some of the most astute, trickiest politicians this country has produced have come out of this background.
Oh, I would say. I mean, these are politicians.
And, I would like to believe this, of course, of everybody, but I really can't see it much here any more than any place else. It seems to me that I will go along wholeheartedly with the first part of it, though, it's the sort of thing that I think that the individual white Southerner has to have a personal knowledge of, because this is, of course, one of the one of the bases of the whole sit-in strategy was that by not hitting back, by taking it, you made these people respect you. Well, I'm not also sure that's true. Some people like to beat on people. They don't give a damn whether they beat back or not, if they think they can get away with it.
Some people do, yeah. Clearly, in the world. Also, some like to be beat up.
Yeah.
For the same token. I don't know what... I don't think the relevant part of the fellow's remarks is a matter of the comparison, because he hasn't been around. Who's been around if they make the comparison mm-hmm. stick? The fact that he did it true there, I thought there was perhaps of some significance, exactly, but he's right or wrong, in fact, he believes there's some significance. What? I don't know exactly. I've heard here in Nashville from people who had something to do with the sit-in negotiations or had some information about them, but the dealing with the southern white owners, the local owners, was much simpler, much more clear-cut, much more straightforward than that with outside owners.
That's certainly what I know about it. It's been true, and it's still true today. Part of course, is just that they're around, that you have the
yes.
people right here that can make the decisions. Part of it is that there aren't all kinds of bureaucratic problems involved. In other words, if the store is a chain store, they might be very willing to open up in Nashville, but they've got a branch in Jackson, Mississippi, too. And this is going to create problems. I think this was what Woolworths got hung up on. Because basically Woolworths doesn't care one way or the other. They had no personal commitment to any point of view on this. But they felt that they would get into all kinds of trouble in other areas.
Hang on, please, sir.